I would like to introduce Sandra de la Losa and Harry Gamboa. Sandra is an artist, activist, and scholar. She is also the founding member of the Pocho Research Society that claims to be a collective of artists, activists, and Mascuache historians who reside in Los Angeles, dedicated to the systematic investigation of space, memory, and displacement. But in actuality, PRS is just Sandra. She investigates erased and invisible history, making symbolically visible this memory through a virtual presence. Sandra currently teaches at the California State University of Northridge. Harry is the source of the term phantom sightings, and one could rightly say sort of the father of contemporary Chicano art. His initiative to found a magazine, a collective, and various interventions places him at the heart of ASCO, conceptual art, and the Chicano movement. He currently teaches at California State University Northridge and CalArts. Please welcome again Sandra and Harry.
First of all, I enjoy the fact that we didn't receive any questions, or very few questions, and that's. And then I was being hopeful, and you could be hopeful that I could read these without my glasses too. So
good, I get to choose what we read. But I thought we were going to begin with your work.
Sandra and I are intending on presenting our just a sort of a brief interview to our newer work, and so maybe that's how we begin actually. So your piece for mine.
I'll begin, but actually I'm gonna present from over there.
Okay, so we'll start with Sandra, and I'll stand up.
And Christina, I'm gonna present from here, but I'm not sure how to access my PowerPoint. Okay. Never mind. Here he goes first.
That's fine. I enjoy the chaos. I thrive on it. What I'll be screening here is sort of a compilation of work I've been doing with a group of performers. I refer to them as the virtual performers. I tell everyone that I continue to be Chicano, but I am post-OSCO. So now we'll show the video, the DVD now. Okay.
Such a mistress, maybe her sister, which is Fate, will come along and keep you company also.
Mm-hmm. I'm not gonna do it. Why am I gonna put myself in a situation that you're not
counting? It's just the way it is.
No, fuck that.
Why do you gotta fight it?
No.
Why?
Why am I gonna be like you, how you are right now?
Me?
No, I'm not gonna do that. I'll fuck that.
You don't know about me.
No.
All right then, fuck it.
Yeah, fuck it. Am I gonna do it? No. No.
People that try to figure out who I am by asking me what my last name is, and then tell me that that's one way of figuring out my nationality, and then they give me like the silent treatment and they ignore me, are in my way. They're in my way. What else can I say? They don't need to be figuring out anything about me. I'm a Chicana. What else do they want to know? They're in my fucking way.
Actually, I learned about through one of Harry's mass emails, and he died at the ripe age of 102. He was the inventor of LSD, for those of you who don't know. And you know, I think he helped us helped us realize that maybe what appears to be really isn't what is. And that has a lot to do with what my installation is about here at LACMA. So my piece is about a monument that's in downtown LA. It's a monument you all probably have driven by 1,000 times but never even looked at or didn't even notice. It's a monument dedicated to the Mormon troops who built a fort there during the Mexican-American War. You know, LA is really, really bad at remembering its history and recognizing its history, and what few monuments are made really kind of refer to an imperialist, colonialist, militaristic history. We got Pershing Square, MacArthur Park, Fort Moore, the Portola Trail. I want to reflect a little bit on the architecture of the monument. This is actually, through my research, who would have known, but this is the largest bas-relief military sculpture in the whole entire United States. And it's 80 feet tall. And it's really kind of an absurd monument. It commemorates a moment in history that is really, really a kind of footnote in history. You know, so it's, you know, the architecture of the monument's immense. It's solid, strong, fortified, it's monumental, it's overwhelming. But this appearance of strength is, I would say, deceiving. And actually, when we actually begin to investigate the actual history of the monument, the official narrative crumbles pretty quickly. Actually, this monument was named after Captain Benjamin D. Moore, who was killed by a California militia at the Battle of San Pascual, in which American troops got a bad beating by the Mexican troops. So we always hear about the victories, but American victories, but we never really hear about the defeats. Also, the American troops at one point in time were surrounded by the local Californios and forced to flee the fort in a battle known as the Siege of Los Angeles. In fact, some of the history sounds much more F-troop style. Actually, half of the American troops fled for the gold fields up north during the Mexican-American War. You know, I guess trying to find gold was much more exciting than war. At one point, a garrison or troop confused a call for California and called all the forces, and someone accidentally dropped a lighted fuse on an ammunition chest, and the explosion destroyed the guardhouse and killed several troops. There's theories that the fort was partly built because of a power battle between Fremont and Kearney, who had their eyes on governorships in a post-Mexican California reality. So I'm gonna try to fly, put it back in order. Let's see. Oops, and we're missing a slide. Okay, so actually I'm just going to go with it. Okay. Actually, the next slide I wanted to show you was a slide of one of the pieces in the show, and it's a painting of Nuestra Señora del Rio de Los Angeles del Rio de Porcincula, which was actually the original name of Los Angeles, given to the area by the Spanish colonizers, You know, my intention in this exhibit and in my installation isn't necessarily to create an authoritative, true counter narrative or counter history, but really to explore the power of myths, especially the power of myths in history. And so I'm creating my own myths, and actually the painting and several of the artifacts are fictional. They're not real artifacts. And it's interesting that some of the feedback I've received and some of the most absurd out there artifacts are actually the real artifacts, and maybe some of the more believable artifacts are actually fictionalized. But this photo actually just documents a little bit of the process that was involved in creating the painting. So we did a lot of research, researched the native flora and fauna of Los Angeles, research on different maps of Los Angeles. I found a map of locations of some of the indigenous pueblos or villages at the time of the Spanish arrival, and played with aesthetics from many different cultures that were a part of that colonial era. And then this was supposed to be the last slide. So this is a photo of the border wall that separates Gaza from Egypt. About 8 kilometers of this massive military apparatus was taken down within a few hours in January of this year. Today, the richest 10% own 85% of global assets, and in the United States, a handful of media conglomerates control approximately 75% of broadcast and cable TV viewing. Maybe things that appear to be impenetrable absolute are much more vulnerable than we think. Maybe a certain global order is maintained by the ability to create mass hallucinations through the weaving of modern myths. But at the same time, we have the power to create our own myths and create new possibilities for what we can live in. So that's what I'm really kind of trying to explore, the power of myth to destabilize what we think is impenetrable. All right, thank you all.
Maybe I have a question for you, Sandra. The notion that you can go to different locations and apply a plaque to give it some importance. I was wondering, what is it that attracted you, first of all, to those places? And are they intended to remain there permanently? And some of the places seem like they're very obscure locations to reach. How would people actually know that they would exist, or should people just stumble upon them by chance?
Well, partly was just what spurred me was just my naivete and not knowing that it's a felony to insert something that causes $400 or more damage. Actually, in 2002, a law was passed in which the amount defined for what is deemed a felony was dropped from $2,000 to $400. So pretty much, you know, a tag these days could be considered a felony. In terms of so luckily I didn't know that when I started doing the plaques. Now I'll be a lot more careful.
Just keep them down to $399.
I'm just going to use cheaper materials and removable wig paste.
And you know, the other thing, Sandra, I think the perspective of what you're talking about in terms of looking at myths and basically trying to destabilize the myth long enough to snap people out of mass hypnosis and the effectiveness of creating something that will jar someone's consciousness, that's quite a bit of power for an individual compared to the conglomerates. And that in itself is sort of an act of great strength and you know, something that could be shared to young people.
Yeah, I hope it inspires others, you know, because history's a subject that's wide open, and there's just so much history here in LA that deserves to be recognized and needs to be told.
Well, and then here's sort of an anecdotal story regarding the Fort Moore. For many years, they would have at the bottom, it was a waterfall for many, many years, and it had a big sort of a pond there.
Right.
And what it became was a receptacle for dead Mexicans, people with the gang members, people that were killing, they were dumping the bodies in there. And so the Herald Examiner made a big thing about it years ago, as a defunct newspaper. So they drained it. And so now, you know, there, I've heard of a few people have slipped and bumped their head in there, but no fatalities.
Yeah, well, one thing I've loved about this project, and one thing I just love about LA is just how rich space holds history, how much a space can hold history. And it's just been amazing, just the different types of stories that have surfaced through this project. And actually, I learned on the night of the opening that actually my mom went to a junior high where the fort is. It was the former headquarters of LAUSD, but it was actually a junior high before it was the LAUSD administrative offices. And actually, there was right next to that junior high was kind of like reform school that my beloved uncle went to as well. So there's a little personal family history that happens at that time.
Well, and also I think there might be a few city planners, if they really could, would transform human beings into mini malls.
So Harry, I have a question for you. You know, so here you are at LACMA, and as we walk into the exhibit, the first piece we see is spray paint LACMA. And, you know, I see you now and then, bump into you at Northridge, and I also probably first saw you in documentaries about the East LA walkout. So you kind of have had this troubled past relationship with institutions. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I was telling people at the opening that my first experience here was I was in the second grade, and I was highly critical of the tar pits on a field trip, claiming that it was all a fraud. And I threw my my little carton of milk and said it would never sink. And when it sank, I spent the rest of the field trip in the school bus. So I figured that I had something going there. I think early on, when I was a young child, I was a monolingual Spanish-speaking child, and I'm 56 years old, so I entered public school when it sort of these behavior that's sort of equivalent to apartheid was standard operating procedure, and I entered the kindergarten class, and they provided me with a big sheet of paper, and I thought I was about to be presented with my first art project, and it kind of was. Teacher helped me formulate a cone and put a chair in front of it, and they. Woman painted something on it, and it said Spanish. They put it on my head, and she told me I could take it off to learn when I learned to speak English. And I had a cousin that was nearby that was bilingual, and he explained it to me, and so I immediately gave out the order to steal the largest dictionary you could find, and I began to read at A, and when I ended at Z, I was ready for a good fight. So yeah, I've been kind of I've been at it for some time.
How about your relationship with educational institutions, and now being a teacher?
Well, you know, I kind of landed as an educator almost. I was actually drafted. I was drafted by a well-known photographer named Alan Sekula, who had attended a conference. I was quite literally picked up off the street because I guess the speaker that was going to participate at a conference at UCLA had ditched or something, and there I was, and someone said, "Well, what are you doing?" I said, "Well, what are you doing?" And they offered me $200. I got in the car, and next thing you know, I was arguing with all these people on stage, I heard I won the argument, and in the end, someone went up and in his style said, "Oh man, that was like really cool." And then I said, "Well, who's that?" And they said, "Well, that's Alan Sekula." And a year later, he asked me to take over his class while he was going on sabbatical at CalArts. And my first week, I had nearly all my students arrested on a project. And I made sure I documented that. And then I was invited to teach all up and on the coast. And I teach now at Cal State Northridge, Sandra, you'll be teaching that too. We teach remedial courses for writing. And what it is, these are young people who have gone all the way through public school, and no one has ever bothered to tell them they do not have third grade reading levels and fourth grade writing levels, and that their behavioral skills need to be polished quite a bit. And I think I'm, and Sandra too, I think a lot of being on the street and having read a tremendous amount of material and having raised two children has really prepared me because I actually love all my students, and I want them all to do well, and I want them to succeed, and so I do everything I can to make sure that that they don't they'll realize it later that their remedial course is really taught like an honors course at Stanford, and they get something out of it that someone wouldn't really expect. So, and Sandra, I've heard a couple stories about sort of this, you know, I guess sort of this reference to the inventor of LSD. In fact, on the day of the opening, my wife Barbara bought me a little button that said LSD, and I decided not to wear it. But I figured it was too large to swallow it. It sort of has to deal with this whole idea of taking a step back and realizing that there's different ways to look at things. There's different ways to affect things, and maybe I'll just mention one of the OSCO pieces, which is Instant Mural, which has been one of these pieces that seems to attract people. And the moment was actually quite interesting, because as Grunk was taping Patsy and Umberto Sandoval to a wall, traffic stopped. People wanted to know if they were hungry, if they needed help, was there any pain involved. Some homeboys came by and asked if they should kick Grunk's ass. The police were circling, but in the end, the performance lasted as long as the length of tape would last, and then they remained motionless, and then they pulled away, and they walked away, and they left. And really, much of oppression really does require the co-participation of the victims. As long as they realize that they're not going to allow themselves to be victimized, there's no way that an oppressor can come and get you. And that's what I try to teach all my young people, and that's what I've been teaching ever since I was a little kid, since they used to allow corporal punishment. And I think many of the people that were at my schools would have been perfect for Guantanamo, because they were basically sadistic in expressing their racism. And fortunately, many of us survived to overcome that and to realize that we would not raise our kids to hate and to actually be very productive. And that's what I learned of a lot.
Your story kind of, I could relate to drug-inspired performances I remember, being a teenager and hanging out at the park and seeing people on PCP and standing in position. We'll talk about endurance performance, standing in the same position for 6 hours and thinking they're on an airplane and flying. But I unfortunately had a lot of friends and family members who really kind of lost their path through experimentation with lots of types of drugs. You know, but on another level, like, I really embrace that spirit of trying to find a way out and people really trying to do that through experimentation with drugs. And I think on a certain level, you know, it did create openings. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, I definitely, you know, very much aware of the other side as well.
So, you know, Sandra, every once in a while when I talk to artists, I've known quite a number of artists, and some of the more spectacular artists, in this city, it's really difficult to be an artist or a writer, a performer, because we're so dominated by the mainstream media. And so to dedicate your work to certain specific work, quite often the sort of the equivalent is the mad scientist, one that goes in the garage and comes out with a blown up hairdo. And so it's not always guaranteed to work, but part of, I think, sort of the, for me, the thing that's always motivated me, in particular with the subject matter of the Chicano artists, is that there's been very little support system, very little financial reward. It's almost guaranteed that you'll starve, things won't go very well, and yet people go head forth and continue to produce and create and generate concepts that are co-equal with any other culture in the world, even though, and also I think much of it has been produced under duress. So it's quite amazing that any work has been done.
Mm-hmm.
And, here we are.
Yeah. I definitely didn't start making art in school, and it was really I think coming, well, actually, what kind of first kind of spurt turned me on to the arts was actually writing classes at Berkeley and studying with Sri Moraga, who always encouraged us to find our voice and also to start from the point where, from a place within ourselves that we didn't have a language to articulate, to name it, mm-hmm. and to begin to name that. And I think it's a testament to a lot of her work, because I think she really did create a space that didn't exist or just wasn't legitimized before. But that act of finding space from within and finding space through the act of creating your own language definitely has influenced who I am. But coming back to LA, I was fortunate to actually get a lot of support from a lot of people who were creating their own spaces and creating a lot of community-based spaces. And some of those people are here, a lot of those people are actually, who are part of those spaces are here today, like the Peace and Justice Center, the Popular Resource Center, spaces like the D Center, Luna Soul Cafe, Proyecto Jardín, so many spaces in which we kind of didn't rely on anyone, kind of in the spirit of OSCO, but kind of did our own thing. And really, it's those activities and those actions that I think really have made it possible for me to do the work that I'm doing, because I'm by no means in dialogue by myself. You know, I'm in dialogue with larger communities.
And so that leads us to our first question. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I need my glasses. Harry, have you drank tequila in Mexico?
I'll tell you, when I went to Mexico City, I've actually exhibited in Mexico City several times, but when I went the first time a couple years ago, I landed at the airport and I immediately fell to my knees and I said, am I supposed to crawl the Basilica now? And they go, only if you're drinking tequila. And so fortunately I had Francesco Siqueiros, who took me to the oldest bar in Mexico City called El Nivel, and it's actually been shut down since then. And we began to drink tequila, and I started telling him that my grandfather had been born in Mexico City and that I was wearing his shoes. And so I was able to retrace all of his paths within a short period of time. And every time I turned a corner, I did drink a little tequila. And here in LA, I rarely drink tequila because I might do more than $400 worth of damage.
I can give you that bit. Who decides what art to include in a Chicano art exhibit? Curators? Why so many important Chicanos are missing from the exhibit? Why post-Chicano movement? All our problems as Chicanos have been solved. We have no more racism. No more discrimination in terms of education. What planet saw artists post-Chicano movement live? Wait, I gotta reread that one. Is that all right? Who decides what to include in a Chicano art exhibit? Well, it depends where the art exhibit is, you know. So in a place like a big museum like this, it's curators. And definitely curators have a lot of power in exhibits. Why so many important Chicano artists are missing from the exhibit? You know, we are looking, we're in a moment, it's 30 years, 40 years of production. I think if we look at the production that is happening today, there's not one round, there's 20 rounds. And so I don't think one show can do the whole job, you know? And I think there's many directions, and instead of one show, and this show, you know, explores a specific realm, I think we need 4 or 5 shows to explore all the different realms. And each realm, each direction of practice, I think, deserves a show.
I think also, in terms of, I believe there were several artists that were invited to participate that declined on their own, didn't want to be tagged in a certain way. There are so many artists doing things, and for most of the time that I've done things, they've taken place in parking lots, on freeways, they've been just in various locations, and very rarely in institutions, and when they have been, I have quite often been the last person to find out about it on some level. But when you're dealing with institutions, it's the institution that's constructing its own reality, and then when it's presented, it's actually the institution's view of whatever that is. So, one might perform here, and then the next week, they're elsewhere if they're busy, and of course if they're concentrated on their work. So this doesn't lock anyone in. The show itself, of course, includes only certain people, and of course that's what happens when you get involved in institutions.
And also, I do want to acknowledge that honestly, like within the show, I really have gotten a lot of support, and I really couldn't. I don't know if I could hope to have a curator as supportive as Rita has been for me. And if I think we look at the country, how many major museums actually have curators who are Chicano? It's probably definitely less than 5. I don't know if it's more than 2. I don't even know if it's more than 1.
I failed math.
What gives you hope about young Chicanos and mixed blood artists? Radio Archives. Here's the website.
Mixed blood artists. What can I say? There's so many beautiful people. How can you avoid it? that's sort of the dystopic view of a Blade Runner is really being confronted with a more optimistic outcome of the intermixing of groups. Because people are sharing and people are growing. And it's not always necessarily about hate. It's really about introducing each other to the different aspects of culture. And so the idea of mixed blood is it's kind of interesting. I think this city in itself is probably one of the reasons it's in the focus of the global attention, even though it's brief, because this is a place where there is that kind of experimentation going on. And people aren't literally hunting each other down based on that.
How does it feel to have your work in a traditional art institution when, as the notion of phantom societies indicates, Chicano art draws its subversive quality from not being institutionalized? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I love doing the plaques, and I think the plaques are effective on a certain level. The installation that I made was made specifically knowing that it's going to be in an institution and knowing that it's going to be a show. Well, I didn't know it initially, but it is going to be a show that's going to travel to different museums. Actually, it's traveling to a couple of museums in Mexico. It's going to travel to, it'll be at the Museo del Barrio in New York. And I think I believe it's traveling to a museum in Houston, And I took it as a great opportunity, and I think I don't know. I think you can be political in an institution, and I think you could create work outside of an institution publicly that also isn't very political. I really took this opportunity knowing that I'm going to reach a wider public than I do reach with my plaques. You know, and that's a great opportunity. Also knowing just from past experiences that in museums, you know, we a lot of students enter, a lot of classes are brought to these institutions. And so I really gain access to an audience wider audience than I think I could hope to have with the other work that I do.
And, I kind of grew up in an era where you were basically forced to choose sides. The inevitable question here on the streets of LA is, where are you from? And so people are always trying to make you make a selection, but I found that, one has to be adaptable. One has to be adaptable for the moment. One has to be able to operate numerous venues, numerous operations, constantly going, multitasking, and to speak multiple languages and multiple styles of that own language. And so when one's showing in an institution, doesn't exactly mean that everything you've ever believed in has fallen to the wayside, because for that particular moment, that's what you're doing. But at the same time, you could be doing quite a number of other things. There's so many big problems going on right now. For instance, the war, the low educational standards, the fact that this whole country, Los Angeles, was just voted to be the most polluted place in the whole country. I mean, and it's so we have so many different kinds of problems. And of course, this is sort of this aesthetic, theoretical problem that's going on. But you know, we can't afford to disregard people, maybe if they're doing certain things, because there are many people doing a lot of work in a lot of different fields. So I think many of the artists that are here in the show are probably participating both as artists, but also as social critics and as advocates on behalf of their own constituency, whatever that might be.
Okay, well, actually, this is a question for the Portmore piece. How do you see the idea of reinvigorating a public monument? Is it either an allowance on part of the city or an archaeological document for the city? The Fort Moore piece is not an authentic historical document of the show. It's an exploration of a site. It's well researched. I had a great time just doing research on so many aspects of LA for this piece. But it's not a real history. I think having a dialogue about LA history really forces us to question LA itself, and so I think it's really, really important, especially because so much history has been obliterated and so much history has been erased. Yes, Mexican history has been obliterated, but Tongva history, as I was very pointedly reminded, even more so. And so I think that exploration, excavation of what is, or also what was, or what could have, just imagining what could have been, is healthy, because it also imagines us to see what we are living in as something temporal, something that's not fixed, something that's going to change, something that is changing, and something that we can be actors and be a part of in that transformation. I think investigating history is something super important, especially I think in this historic moment, I think where hegemony is maintained in large part through amnesia, through this false creation of amnesia. So, why not turn the fountain on? I don't have a feeling I'll get a felony if I do. Please explain how calling or referring to artists as Chicana, Chicano artists who resist this designation can be reconciled. Personally, I don't know, because I'm definitely Chicana, and I guess I'm more Chicana than I am an artist. I'm not so comfortable about calling myself an artist. I don't really feel it important to call what I do art, because it's a lot of other things besides art.
And the guy that could have invented the pill died earlier this week.
So the word artist is a little more problematic than the word Chicana. What teacher, whether in the classroom or through reading or looking at art or in your extended family, has been most influential in your work and successes as an artist?
Wow.
Well, I already named one.
There's a woman here today who used to be my locker partner at Garfield. Her name is Roberta Kemi. So she's one of the few people that saw me in the early stages. But it was about the time that we were about ready to get out of high school when I had straight F's. I'd never taken a test, and I never did a bit of homework the entire time I was in school. I was very good at making paper airplanes, though. At one session, towards the end of my high school experience, there used to be an English teacher, his name was Dr. Owen J. O'Callaghan, who would come to class drunk, wore the same sweater for 20 years, and one day he quite literally just kind of said, well, Gamboa, why don't you hang on a second, and then the class left, and I thought I was about to get another one of these major thrashings, and what he did was pull out an old cup and filled it with some bourbon, and he offered me a cigarette, and he says, have you ever heard of E.E. Cummings? And I said, have you ever heard of Albert Camus? My friend Roberta's reading that right now. And then we had this dialogue about literature, and I had been, of course, reading a lot of different things at that time. I was playing along, but it was the first time I'd ever been sort of treated with a certain level of human respect. And I think he's the person that kind of broke that ice, that it was actually possible to sit down with an adult at that time and have a real critical intellectual discussion in which I was clearly prepared for, but not one that I was going to about to do it in the classroom. And so I think he's a person that really, I think he knew exactly what he was doing. I thanked him actually in my book, and I actually thank Roberta in my book for having influenced me early on to pay close attention to high-level literature.
Okay, how do you respond to those that think this show says Chicanos have arrived? Heard this on Ara Abogado's show. It seems most of the criticism is coming from other Chicanos that are resisting visibility, or is it resisting recognition under terms that one not our own within the institution? Was anyone from the audience want to answer that one?
In the end, we're all going to be phantoms anyway.
Both of you create work that is disruptive. Have you had to find new ways to disrupt the urban daydream that stems to have consumed modern American society? I think the urban daily life disrupts me.
I think that's what artists do, actually. They provide images or words or ideas that actually kind of shock people into consciousness. And that's kind of our job, I think, as artists. Whether we're effective or not, or whether we get rewarded or not, or whether we're recognized or not, And I think that's why so many people are so enthralled, even to the earliest cave paintings. I mean, and that's what tigers are all about too. It's like we just have that in our, I think, our, in our sort of our genetic code, is we have to express our the fact that we do exist. And of course, that's affected by our perception of who we are. And so, you know, that's where all the arguments come up from, as to who's saying what they are, and then what other people say they think they are. Mm. And so I think the term Chicano came about when people used to call us all kinds of derogatory names. I personally have a real difficult time because I realized that the term Hispanic was created by Richard Nixon and then was widely disseminated, so then it would be adopted as a term. And it's an artificial, fake term. It's a big lie. And yet so many people use that term now. And so it's, for me, it hurts when I see people using that term. And even though I recognize it's a very commonly accepted term, if they knew where it came from the deep, dark, criminal White House, then nobody would ever use it.
When an artist's work, a friend who I met during the Democratic National Convention and was an architect, anarchist architect from Spain, he really influenced how I think about art, and I really, you know, I really like the idea of using art as a way of trying to get away with things you shouldn't be able to get away with. Or they, you know, there's roles to try to make you not get away with. Mm-hmm. So anyway, he chaired a project with me in which, like, in a small, I think it was in Sevilla in Spain. Some organizers invited architects, and they did a project to address homelessness. And the way they did it was by inviting architects to design tree houses and have architects build these tree houses in the main plaza and invite homeless people to occupy them. So they did, and all these, you know, architects got out their rulers and made these fun, elaborate, wild tree houses. And the city did not know what to do because there's no law saying that you can't build a tree house in a tree in the plaza area. You know, so there's this big standoff and all these city officials are scratching their heads trying to figure out, like, how to stop this, what to do about it. And what actually happened was they, in the middle of the night, they, like, cleared the plaza, kicked everyone out, and they just mowed down all the trees. Aww.
Well, I've been around since the mid-20th century, and I remember L.A. having so many beautiful trees, and when they introduced helicopter surveillance, they went out and chopped down all the trees. This way they could hunt everybody down. Sort of dealing with this notion of Chicano, I'm not sure if you're all aware at this point in the state legislature of Arizona, there's an attempt to basically outlaw the word Chicano, Chicano studies. They want to outlaw and ban the book written by Rodolfo Acuna, Occupied America, thus validating the book itself. The people who operate Homeland Security and the federal government has actually are promoting that all the other states follow suit. So, it's really not the kind of thing that, Chicanos will probably use the term Chicano until it's against the law.
Okay, the last question I have is, what do you think is the specific legacy of Patsy Valdez for contemporary Chicano art? Yay.
I can't answer for Patsy, I'm sorry.
Well, I think just so many people like Patsy from that generation, you know, who I kind of witnessed maybe when I was like a teenager or in my early 20s. Of course, I think of Dan Gamboa and a lot of the women who are actually going to be part of the show opening at Claremont Art Museum called The Vex. It's a show on Chicanas and East LA punk or something like that. Hope you all have heard that. It's opening in 2 weeks. Definitely was that generation continues to be very inspiring, just on so many different levels, just visually, just in terms of their fashion, and of course in their artwork, and just the kind of the boldness, the unapologeticness in their, not even just in their artwork, but just in their being. And so it's more that, maybe more that spirit. That spirit that kind of inspires me.
So I want to thank both Sandra and Harry for being this afternoon, and thanks for sharing this with us.
Thank you, Christian. Thank you, Sandra.